A quick heads up.
Swearing.
And sex.
Got it.
Good. Imagine it's summer 1937 in East Hampton. The Atlantic Ocean is sparkling in the midday sun. And if you squint, are you squinting?
Yes, I'm squinting. God, so bossy.
Okay, so if you squint, you can make out one swimmer who's farther out than all the others. It's 8-year-old Jacqueline Bouvier.
Okay, what's she doing all the way out there?
So Jackie's father dared her to swim out as far as she can. Her muscles already ache and salt stings her eyes. But in the distance, she can see the last barrel floating just above the water, a benchmark that only the strongest swimmers can hit. And she's determined to get there. A big wave rolls in and knocks Jackie back. She gasps for air and spits the salty water out of her mouth. She glances back at the shore. Should she just turn around? She sees umbrellas lining the beach. From here, they're just colorful dots. The uniformed waitstaff scurrying from table to table look like tiny black ants. This is the Maidstone Beach Club, where she and her family rub elbows with other ultra-rich, elite New Yorkers. During the summer, Jackie stays at her grandfather's house down the road. It boasts a stable, a tennis court, and an Italian fountain filled with goldfish. It's a cushy life, and her future has all been laid out for her. When she gets older, she'll be expected to marry well. She'll fill her days organizing photo albums and sipping tea at charity events. She'll follow all the rules her mom's already teaching her. Never put your elbows on the table. When wiping your mouth, only use the interior of the napkin. Turn teacup handles to 3 o'clock. Stir your spoons from 12 to 6 without making a clinking sound.
What if you like the clinking sound?
Then no tea for you.
Oof, harsh.
But out here on the water, life is still wild, unpredictable. Back on land, that's her mother's world. The ocean is her father's. Jackie imagines her parents watching her from the shore, her mother shaking her head with a pinched look on her face, her father, who everyone says looks just like Clark Gable, cheering Jackie on. Unlike his wife, he doesn't give a damn about the rules. He believes in living life to the fullest, wherever that takes him. Jackie's heard enough of their fights to know her mother's about to leave him. She'll probably have to go live with her mother, who won't ever let her swim out this far again. Jackie is exhausted from fighting against the waves, but she keeps the barrel in her crosshairs. She's going to reach it. She knows she'll never have the freedom her father has. She's not a man, and this is still the 1930s. But in her own way, however she can, she's going to try. From Wondery, I'm Arisha Skidmore-Williams.
And I'm Brooke Ziffrin.
And this is Even the Rich, where we bring you absolutely true and absolutely shocking stories about the greatest family dynasties the world has ever seen.
It's a show about power, how you get it, how you keep it, and what happens when it goes to your head.
It's also about how the rich are just like us, because even the rich love and cry and dream and hope.
And tweet memes during Oprah interviews.
So, Brooke, you know how much I love the Kennedys.
I think you mean how much we both love them. I mean, this is our third season on them, after all.
Okay, fair. But we're finally getting to the Kennedys who put the Kennedys on the map. Jack and Jackie, the Playboy president and the first lady of fashion. On our last two series, we talked a lot about influencers who lived their private lives in public. But now, we're going to tell you the story of a couple who were as private as they were famous. And as you're about to learn, there's a big difference between Jack and Jackie, the people, and Jack and Jackie, the legends. This is episode one, Queen Deb. Okay, Brooke, let's play word association. When I say Jackie O, what do you think?
Pearls, obviously. Mm-hmm. Pink Chanel skirt suit. Pillbox hat, mm-hmm. You know, ladylike.
Yes, that's exactly what I thought too. But behind closed doors, Jackie wasn't really like that at all. Whenever she had a choice, she wore pants and went barefoot. And she smoked 2 packs a day.
What? Wait, hold on. Is that why she had that breathy voice? She couldn't get enough oxygen?
Maybe. But the point is, Jackie is complicated. People who worked at the White House called her, by far, the most complex of all the first ladies. And to understand why, you've got to start with her parents.
Yes. I remember squinting with them at the beach a couple minutes ago.
Jack and Janet. They're a study in contrast. Her father, Jack Bouvier, is charming and mischievous. Her mother, born Janet Lee, is stern and formal. But they do have one thing in common. They both belong to a very specific social class. I don't know what historians call it, but I'm going to call it old money-ish.
Call ABC. We've got a show.
Janet Lee traces her family roots back to Robert E. Lee, the Confederate general. But while her family's last name really is Lee, the truth is they're not related to the general. They came over from Ireland during the potato famine and spotted an opportunity. Americans weren't exactly welcoming of the Irish back in the day, so it was in their best interest to fit in. And if your last name's already Lee, why not claim the most famous Lee in the South as your forefather?
Okay, solid strategy.
Meanwhile, the Bouvier side of the family claims to be descended from French aristocrats who hobnobbed with Napoleon.
And is that true?
Nope. Jack's ancestors were cattle herders. I mean, maybe they were lucky enough to herd Napoleon's cows, but I doubt it.
Okay, so both of Jackie's parents trace their roots to con artists?
Yeah, you'd think that would be a solid foundation for a marriage, right? Shockingly, it's not. Because while they both care about their place in society, Jack and Janet have very different attitudes towards money. Namely, Janet likes to spend it well, and Jack likes to spend it poorly. He's a gambler and a drinker and a serial womanizer.
Sounds like true love.
I mean, his nicknames pretty much tell you everything you need to know about the guy. People call him the Black Orchid, the Black Sheik, and most commonly, Blackjack. Janet's willing to turn a blind eye to his philandering as long as he's discreet. Unfortunately, he's not. In 1940, the New York Daily Mirror posts a story that will add another nickname to his collection, the Love Commuter. The gossip piece also includes photos of several of Blackjack's lady friends. And let's just say, Janet does not do humiliation. This is the final straw. She's had enough. They divorce that same year. 10-year-old Jackie is devastated. Her sister Lee is only 6, so she doesn't completely understand what's happening. But for Jackie, this is the worst thing that could ever happen. Her world is crashing down around her. Jackie's always been closest to her father. He's the one who believes in her. He's the one who makes life fun. On the weekends, it's ice cream sundaes and dressing up for dinners at fancy restaurants. And there's nothing she likes more than tagging along with him to casinos and to the racetrack. And on special occasions, they go to boxing matches. But now, Jackie's only going to see her father on holidays and summer weekends. The rest of the time, she'll be with her mother. And Janet thinks she can't do anything right. When she stays with Janet, all she hears is, "Jackie, you read too much for a girl. Jackie, your hands and feet are too big. Jackie, your hair's too thick and frizzy. Jackie, pull yourself together. You look sloppy."
Okay, Janet would have an aneurysm if she saw what we wear to our recording session.
Oh my God, definitely. Because Janet runs her household like a debutante drill sergeant. She schools her daughters in how to walk, what to wear it, and how to talk. The end goal is to marry rich. Janet even shows her daughters how it's done when she marries her second husband, Hugh D. Auchincloss, an heir to the Standard Oil fortune. Hugh is the polar opposite of Blackjack. He's so boring that Gore Vidal, Hugh's former stepson, once compared his personality to a magnum of chloroform.
Ooh, burn.
I know, right? But he's Janet's golden ticket to the top of the social ladder. They move into a mansion near D.C. set on 46 rolling acres. In the summer, they'll retreat to their 28-room cottage in Newport, Rhode Island. And their children will get enormous trust funds that kick in when they turn 21.
Oh, great. So Jackie and Lee are set for life.
Sorry, let me rephrase that. All of Hugh D's biological kids will be set for life. Ugh. Jackie and Lee will have to rely on whatever Blackjack leaves them, which at this point looks like nothing. So now there's even more pressure on the girls to marry rich. At 15 years old, Janet ships Jackie off to Miss Porter's school, a finishing school with the express purpose of turning young women into perfect wives. She's drilled in proper etiquette and how to hold refined conversations, encouraged to speak softly, listen, and not interrupt. The girls take turns waiting tables so they'll know how to properly host dinner parties.
Okay, well, obviously you and I don't need that class because our game nights with only dips and cookies are always a hit.
Truly legendary.
Jackie goes through the motions. On the outside, she molds herself into the kind of woman who wears Chanel and pearls. On the inside, though, she's as rebellious as ever. She's still the girl who won't quit until she swims out to the last barrel. She can sense a life beyond what she's being taught at school. She catches glimpses of it in books and art. So while the other girls socialize after class, Jackie retreats to her room, curls up in bed, and reads Chekhov and Byron. At the end of the year, when she's asked to list her life ambition for the yearbook, Jackie gives Miss Porter's school a very demure F you. She writes, "Not to be a housewife." It's the summer of 1945 in Newport, Rhode Island, and it's 16-year-old Jackie's first debutante season. She spent the last few weeks attending party after party. This evening, she's in a simple black cocktail dress. She wears red lipstick and long white gloves to cover the hands her mom still says are too big. She's not sure if she's pretty. She describes herself as tall with a square face and eyes so far apart that it takes 3 weeks to have a pair of glasses made. But the boys have started paying attention to her. For the past half hour, a handsome Harvard freshman has been telling her about a book he's just read about France during World War II. And it's giving Jackie a chance to practice the unspoken rules of courtship among the social elite. Rule number one, never let on that you know more than a boy. This boy's been mangling every French name that crosses his lips. But Jackie, who speaks fluent French, by the way, limits her responses to, "Go on," and "so interesting." She wants him to feel smart, at least smarter than her. Which brings us to rule number two. Talk as softly as you can. Talk softly enough, the boys won't realize she can also talk softly in French, Italian, Spanish, and German.
Damn.
Yeah. 20 minutes later, on the patio with the sun setting over the Atlantic, Jackie shares a cigarette with a girlfriend. We actually have this exchange on record, so I'm just going to read it. Jackie tells her friend that she wanted to give him a big maternal kiss on the cheek and tell him he was really a big boy now.
Okay, I like this, Jackie.
Yeah. But as opinionated and headstrong as Jackie can be, she knows she has to play along. If she wants to stay in the world she was born into, she doesn't have a choice. And it turns out, Jackie's good at pretending. By the end of the season, she's named Queen Deb.
Okay, for us non-debutantes, what does that mean? Because it does not sound fancy.
It means she's like the prom queen, but for the entire East Coast instead of just her school. Her marriage prospects couldn't be better. But as Jackie turns 17, then 18, then 19, then 20, her friends start getting married, and Jackie doesn't. She's not against marriage, but none of the boys she meets excite her. They already know exactly which firms they'll work at and which country clubs they'll be members of. But Jackie wants a life she can't even imagine yet. So after graduating from college, she takes a stab at creating that life for herself. She applies for Vogue's prestigious Prix de Paris Award, which would take her to New York for 6 months, then Paris for six more. She crafts 6 essays for the application and sprinkles them with quotes from Oscar Wilde and Charles Baudelaire. On paper, unlike at debutante balls, she can be herself. Witty, well-read, ambitious. And she wins the prize over thousands of other applicants.
Nice, go Jackie.
Yeah. But on her first day in the New York office, she meets Vogue's managing editor. The editor raises her nose, takes one look at her, and asks, "How old are you?" 20? 21? 22, Jackie replies.
Okay, what does that mean?
It means that back in those days, most girls are married by 20. And this job is going to take Jackie off the market for another year. By the time she returns home to DC, she'll be 23. She's already close to her expiration date. Does she want to risk it?
Expiration date? She's a woman, not a bag of old chips.
Yeah. At 23, I couldn't even commit to a coffee order. Forget about a marriage. But these are different times. And as the editor looks Jackie up and down, Jackie's panic rises. Finally, the editor offers some advice. "You seem like a smart girl. If you want to get married, you should get back to DC. That's where all the boys are."
And what does Jackie do?
Jackie does as she's told. She packs her bags and heads back to DC with her tail between her legs. And within a couple months, she meets John Husted, a 24-year-old stockbroker. He's everything she's been running away from. But somehow, this feels different. John falls in love with her instantly, and his devotion reminds Jackie of a love story from one of her books. Within a month, he asks her to marry him. They've only been on a few dates. She's living in DC and he's in New York. But she says yes.
Sounds like an episode of The Bachelor.
It's one I might watch. The engagement is announced in the New York Times in January of 1952. And Jackie meets her future mother-in-law, Helen Armstrong Husted, soon after. They sit on over-upholstered couches in an Upper West Side living room. Helen plays hostess, serving little sandwiches and pouring tea.
Okay, sounds like someone else took those elective hostess classes.
Definitely. 28 years ago, Helen was also a debutante, and her life worked out perfectly. She married a lawyer, raised a beautiful family, and now, in her spare time, volunteers for food drives. At the end of lunch, Helen pulls out the family album. Here's me and John's father at our wedding. And here we are at our country club. Jackie sees her own future being laid out before her. The walls start closing in. When Helen offers Jackie a baby picture of her darling little boy, Jackie hears herself snap, "If I want a picture of John, I can take one myself."
Oh, shit.
Jackie didn't mean to say that out loud, but she's having trouble breathing, and she feels even more trapped when John slips an engagement ring onto her finger, and it's his mom's.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, every time Jackie looks down at the ring, it's a reminder of everything she doesn't want. Once she's back in D.C., she stops returning John's calls and makes excuses for why she can't see him. Finally, though, he puts his foot down and flies out from New York to see her. It's late on a Sunday in March 1952. The terminal at National Airport in Washington, D.C. is packed. People are running to catch their flights. Jackie stands with her fiancé, John, at the Eastern Airlines gate. She's seeing him off for his flight back to New York. They make small talk about his trip. Maybe they recount their visit to the National Zoo or talk about the movie they saw. But then, John's plane is called over the loudspeaker. "I gotta go," he tells her, and they embrace. In this moment, Jackie slips the engagement ring into the pocket of John's khakis. No one notices. No one but John. His heart breaks, but to his credit, he doesn't say a word.
Oh, man. This is like every rom-com in reverse. They're supposed to get engaged at the airport, not break up.
I know. But he just kisses Jackie on the cheek, wishes her well, and walks away toward his gate. Jackie walks quietly towards the exit, deep in thought. Without that ring on her finger, her life feels like it's hers again. But she still needs to figure out what it is she wants to do with it.
Looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank?
Literally always.
Okay. Well, the new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look, and it comes in luxe gold packaging. It feels incredibly high-end, but it is a lot more affordable.
Oh, yeah. The Panorama Mascara lives up to its name by giving your lashes panoramic volume and a fully fanned-out look. Its tapered mascara wand catches every single lash, including those hard-to-reach corner lashes. When I do wear makeup, I do the bare minimum, and that's usually eyeliner and mascara and lip gloss. And so mascara has to really pop.
Yes.
And let me tell you, L'Oreal, this baby pops.
Yeah. I do love the packaging. Like, I'm all about that.
So if you're looking for an affordable mascara that gives you voluminous, lengthened lashes, you can buy the Panorama Mascara on Amazon today.
So as a listener of Even the Rich, you know that audio piques the imagination, which is why we're so excited for Audible's new collection of exclusive thrillers. They feature captivating sound design, eerie soundscapes, and dynamic performances that really bring the story to life.
Oh, yeah. The next listen on my list is the psychological thriller, The Silent Patient.
Ooh.
So it's all about a therapist who tries to unravel the mystery of a woman who refuses to talk or give any explanation as to why she shot her husband. I mean, it's going to be the perfect binge listen, and you know I love my thrillers.
I can agree. And as an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog.
Yeah, new members can try Audible now free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/eventherich or text eventherich to 500-500.
That's audible.com/eventherich or text eventherich to 500-500 to get started.
It's a moonless night on August 2nd, 1943. 26-year-old Jack Kennedy can't see what's in front of him or what's behind him. The only thing he can hear right now is his labored breathing and the nearby splashing of his crew as they kick out into the black Pacific Ocean. He listens for any new, unfamiliar sounds. This area is known for its sharks and barracudas. But mostly, he puts his energy into swimming. He's exhausted. One stroke at a time, he tells himself. He doesn't have a destination in mind. All he knows is that he's in the Solomon Islands. An hour ago, he was the naval lieutenant of Patrol Torpedo Boat 109. But now, he's shipwrecked. A Japanese destroyer snuck out of the darkness and smashed his PT boat in two. The fuel tanks exploded, and the fireball sent Jack and his whole crew overboard. He quickly scrambled and was able to locate all of his men but two. But Jack isn't going to lose anyone else. So here he is in the middle of the ocean. The salty water stings his eyes. His lungs are burning. With every labored stroke, he leads 10 other men into the unknown. One of these men, he's dragging by the strap of his life jacket with his teeth.
Oh my God, this sounds like a Liam Neeson film.
Totally insane, right?
Yeah.
Especially considering Jack isn't known for being the model of health. When he was 2 years old, Jack contracted scarlet fever, and it nearly killed him. Then there was the whooping cough, chicken pox, measles, and multiple ear infections. To top it off, he injured his back playing football at Harvard, which left him with severe pain.
Okay, with that record, he should have never left the house.
Yeah, but that isn't an option when you're born a Kennedy. His father, Joseph Kennedy, is already one of the richest men in the country and has very high expectations for his 9 children. He repeatedly tells them, "We want no losers around here, only winners."
Wow, go team.
Yeah. And the motto breeds competition, especially between Jack and his older brother, Joe Jr. Joe Jr. is the firstborn and the golden child. He's a star athlete, a natural leader, and unlike Jack, the very picture of health. But Jack doesn't like being number two. He has something to prove. He pushes himself constantly to compete with his older brother in wrestling, boxing, and boating. And even though Joe Jr. almost always wins, Jack never gives up. And it's that intense will and determination that motivates Jack to push his aching body, to keep swimming, to keep moving. After 5 long hours, the remaining crew members arrive at a small island, no bigger than a football field. But it turns out there's nothing to eat or drink there, and they're sitting ducks. The longer they stay put, the more likely a Japanese patrol will spot them. So Jack takes to the water again, searching for an ally PT boat to send an SOS. But with no luck and time ticking away, Jack returns. He takes a big gamble and leads all his men back into the ocean. They swim for 3 grueling hours against the current.
Okay, tell me something good happens.
Something good happens.
No, you know what I mean. Does something good actually happen?
Yes. They find a slightly bigger island with coconuts.
Ooh.
As they eat and drink from the sweet fruit, 2 local fishermen spot them. Jack scrawls a message into the husk of a coconut. 11 alive, need small boat, Kennedy, and gives it to the men. After a week stranded in the Pacific, help finally arrives with food, water, and cigarettes. All 11 men who survived the initial attack return home as heroes, but none of them is as revered as Jack Kennedy, the one who saved them all. With his famous last name, the nation takes notice. The story hits the front pages of all the newspapers. The New York Times runs a headline, "Kennedy's son is hero in Pacific as destroyer splits his boat." Jack receives a number of medals, including the Purple Heart, and his father receives congratulatory letters from leaders around the world. Joe Sr. cheerfully answers every last one of them.
"You're my boy, Blue."
I'm sure. But you know who's not as thrilled about Jack's heroic deeds?
Oh, let me guess. Big brother Joe Jr.?
Bingo. Joe Jr. is also a naval officer, and he isn't impressed. He says Jack shouldn't have let his boat go down in the first place. He doesn't understand why people are oohing and aahing over a failed mission.
Man, these two take sibling rivalry to a whole new level.
Truly. Joe Jr.'s used to being the son who gets all the attention. He didn't expect his little brother to steal the spotlight, and it's about to get even worse. It's September 6th, 1943, in Hyannisport, Massachusetts. Heavy sterling silver knives scrape against fine china, The dining room at the Kennedy compound is abuzz with chatter. High society friends and close family have gathered at the white-framed clapboard home to celebrate old Joe's 55th birthday. In his naval uniform, the handsome, strapping Joe Jr. has flown home from England to attend this affair. He's been given the prime seat right next to his father. All is as it should be. A family friend clinks his glass. A toast. Joe Jr. raises his own glass as the man stands. The friend looks at old Joe and says, "To Ambassador Joe Kennedy, father of our hero, our own hero, Lieutenant John F. Kennedy of the United States Navy."
Oh boy, I'd like to see the look on Joe Jr.'s face right now.
Yeah, I'm imagining a very, very stiff smile. Not a smize, as Tyra would say. And Jack's not even there. He's still in the hospital recovering from the ordeal. But even from a distance, he's stealing the spotlight. Later that night, a guest who's sleeping over in the room next to Joe Jr. reportedly hears him crying and muttering, "By God, I'll show them."
Oh no, I sense a bad decision coming.
Well, when Joe Jr. returns to his post in England, he volunteers for a dangerous secret mission. He probably sees it as his one chance to top his brother and return his family to its natural order. All he'll have to do is fly an experimental plane loaded with 10 tons of explosives, lock onto a target, turn on autopilot, and then parachute out before the plane hits the target and explodes.
Oh, is that all he has to do?
Yeah, so easy, right?
Yeah.
And there are so many signs telling Joe Jr. to abort the mission. All the test flights fail. Another pilot warns him that the electronics on the plane aren't working properly, but he won't call it off. He's desperate to be the family hero. It's Sunday, August 13th, 1944, in Hyannisport. The windows are open and the ocean breeze wafts over the youngest Kennedy children. They're playing with their mother, Rose, in the living room near 27-year-old Jack. He keeps readjusting himself on the sofa, trying to get comfortable, but he just can't. Since the PT boat incident, his back keeps giving out. Whenever he moves, he has crushing pain. For the past year, he's basically been living at the Chelsea Naval Hospital. All he's had to do is worry about getting better. When he's up to it, Jack will figure out what he wants to do with the rest of his life. And now that he's a war hero, he's a man with a ton of options. During his senior year at Harvard, Jack wrote a thesis on British foreign policy and the start of World War II. His professors convinced him to publish it, and the book, Why England Slept, became a bestseller.
Not bad for a college kid.
Yeah. Jack could just stay the course and become an author. He loves reading, he loves writing. Or there's law school, or maybe a career in academics, a professor perhaps.
Good afternoon and welcome to Econ 101.
The point is, he has choices. Basically, the world is his oyster. It's not like that for his brother, Joe Jr. His path has been laid out for him from the start. His father, Joe Sr., had hoped to be the first Catholic president, but the nation wasn't ready for a non-Protestant commander-in-chief. Thinking the next generation would be more accepting, Joe Sr. put all his dreams onto his firstborn baby boy. He even tells reporters, "This child is the future president of the nation." And he isn't kidding. Everything Joe Jr. does, all of his studies, all of his achievements, everything is part of a bigger plan to become the president of the United States of America.
Jeez, no pressure.
And all Jack has to worry about at the moment is trying to find a better position on the couch, something comfortable enough that he can take a nap. He closes his eyes. He hears his mother, Rose, scrambling to the door. And then it all becomes a blur. He can see two priests in the entry. He hears his mom race upstairs to wake his father from a nap. He hears his parents race back down. And then the crying. Joe Jr. isn't missing in action like Jack was after his PT boat sank. In this case, there's no mistaking what happened. 20 minutes after taking off, Joe Jr.'s plane exploded in midair with Joe Jr. still inside.
Oh, man.
For the next few days, Joe Sr. shuts himself away in his bedroom, listening to somber music. When he emerges, he summons Jack to his office. Jack later recalls the meeting saying, "It was like being drafted. My father wanted his oldest son in politics. Wanted isn't the right word. He demanded it." He'd been planning Joe Jr.'s life since the moment he'd been born. As one friend of the family put it, it was as though Joe Kennedy had mounted, with painstaking attention to the smallest detail, a drama intended to be long and triumphant, only to see the curtain rung down with cruel finality after the prologue. Now, Joe Sr. is determined that the show must go on, and Jack will take his older brother's place.
And how does Jack feel about that?
Well, I think Jack always secretly wanted to be the one who'd run for president. Joe Jr. cared about following the rules and living up to his parents' expectations, but Jack always cared about ideas. Even as a kid, he stayed up late reading books about democracy and American history. So Jack's ready to take his brother's place in his father's master plan. And by the end of 1945, Jack throws his hat into the political arena. He sets out to grab a seat in the House of Representatives. But as Jack starts campaigning and giving speeches, it becomes glaringly apparent how inexperienced he is. Yes, he has a way with words, but that's as a writer, not as a speaker.
Okay, wait, hold on. I'm having a hard time picturing this. I thought JFK was like one of the great orators of the 20th century.
Well, he gets there eventually, but that's not how things start out. At 28, Jack has a tendency to talk too quickly, keep his eyes on his speech, and speak in a monotone, high-pitched voice. And he can't riff to save his life.
Is he also naked in front of a high school auditorium?
No, but it's bad. After Jack fumbles a speech, so every time he gives one, Jack and Joe Sr. sit down and painstakingly review it like game tape, analyzing every little detail. But speaking isn't Jack's only weakness. He's also not very outgoing. On the campaign trail, he's not kissing strangers' babies or mingling with the locals.
Oh, come on, man. You gotta kiss the babies.
I know. It's what makes you a politician. And Joe Sr.'s getting a little nervous. I mean, he's now put all his eggs in Jack's basket and a ton of his own money into the campaign. But then the Kennedy men get a surprise. The voters like Jack. They like his shyness. They like that he's not a career politician. They like that he doesn't come across as insincere or full of shit. To them, Jack is a breath of fresh air. He doesn't condescend or belittle them by pretending to be their friend. And even though he's young, he seems smart. Plus, he's a war hero. In the 1946 elections, Jack wins by a landslide. He defeats his Republican opponent with 73% of the vote and becomes the U.S. representative for the 11th Congressional District of Massachusetts.
Woo woo! Pass the champagne!
Enchanté! Now that he's in the House, the Senate's just a hop and a skip away. And after that, the presidency. Joe Sr.'s plan for the next generation of Kennedys is back on track. Except for one detail. If Jack's going to go all the way, he needs a wife. And Jack has no interest in settling down. His own father's womanizing is legendary. He cheats on Rose constantly. But Jack takes it to another level. Even though he's scrawny and sickly, he's a self-described sexual maximalist. He claims he gets horrible headaches if he goes 3 days without sex.
Okay, now this is in no way medical advice, but I'm 100% sure that's not a real thing.
I 100% agree with you. But his bad health actually seems to be an asset. As a friend of his puts it, he has money, looks, and sympathy. A roommate of his at the time says he's never seen anything like it. In his words, Jack would just look at women and they'd tumble. In the 40s and early 50s, he dates a bevy of stars like Joan Crawford, Lana Turner, Hedy Lamarr, Susan Hayward, and Zsa Zsa Gabor. But none of these stunning women manage to hold Jack's attention for very long. He can't seem to commit to a relationship, and truthfully, he doesn't want to. He likes his bachelor lifestyle way too much. But then, in 1952, Joe Sr. and Jack set their sights on the Senate. If Jack wins, 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue will be within striking distance. And you can't run for president if you're single, which means it's time for Jack to find a wife.
We all face stress in our daily lives. What if the answer to a better stress response is in one key nutrient? I'm talking about magnesium, and specifically Magnesium Breakthrough by Bioptimizers. This one-of-a-kind product is designed to reverse low levels of magnesium, which could have a positive effect on our stress response. But don't take my word for it. Here's a quote from a 2020 issue of the scientific journal Nutrients. Results suggest that stress could increase magnesium loss, causing a deficiency. And in turn, magnesium deficiency could enhance the body's susceptibility to stress, resulting in a magnesium and stress vicious circle. I only recommend Magnesium Breakthrough by Bioptimizers. It's the only organic full-spectrum magnesium supplement that includes 7 unique forms of magnesium for stress resilience and better sleep. Simply go to bioptimizers.com/ifstories, promo code ifstories10 to get your Magnesium Breakthrough and find out this month's gift with purchase. That's bioptimizers.com/ifstories, promo code ifstories10.
Life is busier than ever. It might be harder to find time these days to grocery shop, prep, and cook healthy and hearty meals. I get it. But Factor's got you covered.
Yeah, so Factor's fresh, never frozen meals are chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, delivered right to your door, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes.
Exactly. And Factor is tailored to your schedule. You can customize your weekly meals with the flexibility to get as much or as little as you need. If you're traveling or still finishing up last week's meals, you can always pause or reschedule deliveries.
I mean, I know I've talked before about how much I love Factor because it's just so easy.
And it doesn't taste like, you know, the microwavable yes. meals you see, especially in rom-coms when we're trying to heighten and highlight how sad and pathetic this woman's life is.
Yeah.
They don't taste like that. They taste so good as if you made them yourself or hired a chef. Head to factormeals.com/rich50 and use code rich50 to get 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next box. That's code rich50 at factormeals.com/rich50 to get 50% off your first box, plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
It's May 8th, 1952 in Georgetown. It's a cool spring evening and the flowers are blooming. 33-year-old Jack waltzes up the steps of his friends Charlie and Martha Bartlett's row house. He reaches for the brass knocker, but stops himself. He knows that a dinner party at the Bartlett's is never just a dinner party. Charlie and Martha treat matchmaking like a sport. They probably keep a running tally of successful matches in a shared diary. They'll seat Jack next to a young woman and expect him to make painful small talk all night long. When it comes to women, Jack prefers to skip that step. But he also knows that the Bartlett's are relentless. They'll keep inviting him over every weekend until he meets whatever woman they have in mind for him. So he may as well just get this over with. The door opens. The Bartlett's say, "Hello, hello," and usher him inside. Only one seat at the dinner table is unclaimed. And it's right across from a stunning young brunette who's about 5'7" with a squarish face and wide-set eyes.
Jackie.
That's right.
Is it love at first sight?
Actually, they've laid eyes on each other before. Jack once tried to pick her up on the train.
Of course he did.
And at another dinner party. But that was back when Jackie was engaged to the other John Houston. So, as they sip old fashions, Jack swallows his pride and starts making small talk. But to his surprise, it quickly stops feeling like small talk. He mentions a book he's just bought. She's already read it. He cracks a joke. She tops it. It's like they're dancing. Whatever move he throws down, she can do it backwards.
And in heels.
She's well-read and sarcastic and lightning quick on her feet. And at the end of the night, or so the story goes, Jack leans over the asparagus and asks Jackie out on a real date. Just the two of them.
And what does she say?
I imagine she hesitates for a moment. In Jackie's account of the night, she says that Jack gave her the strong impression of a man who did not want to marry. But she's also intrigued. She's never met a man like him. So Jackie follows her heart. She leans in, meeting Jack over the asparagus, and with her soft voice says, "Yes."
Damn, that asparagus is getting more action than most people at this party.
I should take notes. Jackie later tells a friend that in that moment, she was frightened, envisioning heartbreak for herself, but swiftly determined that such a heartbreak would be worth it. Over the next few months, Jack and Jackie begin spending time together, or as much time as Jack can spare. Running for the Senate is time-consuming and keeps him on the road, campaigning for days and weeks at a time. But when they're together, they make the most of it. They go to the movies, mostly westerns and flicks about the Civil War, Jack's favorites. They play games like Monopoly and Scrabble. They're both viciously competitive. But to Jack's amazement and delight, Jackie almost always wins. And they read together. According to Jackie, Jack isn't a flower and candy type. Instead of red roses and chocolates, Jack gives her novels.
Okay, not my thing, but good for Jack.
You'd hate that. They constantly swap books. Jack gives her some of his favorite books on British history, which she gobbles up. Jack takes an interest in whatever Jackie's reading too. Jackie later says, "When I was reading about the 18th century, he'd snatch a book from me and read and know all of Louis XV's mistresses before I would."
Ah, learning from the best, I see.
Seriously. But this relationship's about more than sex for Jack. He's fascinated by Jackie. They're both naturally private people who can turn their charm on and off like a switch. But when they're together, something else happens. Whether they're talking or just silently reading, an electric current always runs between them. He's never felt that before. And Jackie feels it too. She's falling hard. Jack's the first man she's ever met who checks all her boxes.
Okay, let's see. Box one, attractive?
Obviously, check. He has clear blue eyes, a quick smile, wild reddish hair, and some weird animal magnetism going on.
Okay, box two, wealth?
Of course. His Kennedy Trust Fund made him a millionaire when he was only 21. This guy is Janet approved.
And what's box number three? Alcoholic philanderer? Untrustworthy womanizer?
Actually, kind of. I mean, Jackie's always worshipped her dad, who, let's remember, was always cheating on her mom. And he never apologized for it. So he basically taught her that charismatic men cheat, and that's just a fact of life.
Oh, yikes.
The writer George Plimpton said it best. Jackie loved pirates. Her father was one. So was Jack. All her life, Jackie's balked at rules and predictability. But if she marries Jack, she knows she'll get a big, wild, unpredictable life. She'll be back out in the Pacific Ocean, as far away from her mother's world as she can get. And that's exactly what she wants. But deep down, she also knows that Jack's still not the marrying kind. There's only one thing that can change that.
Putting polygamy back on the books?
Or winning the Senate. His father's told him, if he wins, he'll have to wife up. No way around that. Nobody will take him seriously as a politician if he's not a family man. So if Jackie wants Jack, she's gonna have to pray he wins. And it's gonna take a lot of praying. Jack's running for a Senate seat that's currently occupied by a very popular sitting Republican, Henry Cabot Lodge Jr. Lodge is a Protestant blue blood and comes from one of New England's most prominent political families. Plus, he has the backing of presidential nominee Dwight D. Eisenhower. Jack, on the other hand, is Catholic and 15 years younger than Lodge. His religion and his youth are working against him. As Election Day grows closer, all signs point to Jack losing. Finally, on November 4th, 1952, the voters of Massachusetts take to the polls. And in a nail-biter, Jack narrowly scrapes by, winning the Senate seat by only 70,000 votes.
I hear wedding bells.
Not so fast. Jack does invite Jackie to President Eisenhower's inaugural ball, but still, no proposal comes. In fact, he starts dating Audrey Hepburn on the side.
What the fuck?
Yeah. Jack still isn't ready to give up his bachelor lifestyle. He's terrified of the idea. But Jackie's not going to give up that easily. She's now writing a column for the Washington Times Herald, where she interviews people about everyday life. And she starts asking more serious questions to get Jack's attention. While before, she asked questions like, are beauty operators and barbers entitled to tips? She's now asking, Malkinov said all issues between the United States and Russia are solvable by peaceful means. Do you agree?
Oh, those papers are going to fly off the shelves.
And in her spare time, she translates books from French to help Jack buff up on French Indochina policy. But Jackie's mom is watching all of this from afar and shaking her head. She thinks that in order to get a man like Jack to propose, you have to play hard to get. Men like him like the chase, like to be the pursuer, not the pursued. So Janet comes up with an idea, more like a scheme. To make Jack the pursuer, Jackie needs to become less available. And what better way to be less available than to be thousands of miles away over the Atlantic Ocean in England? Janet thinks Jackie should go cover Queen Elizabeth's coronation for her column. At first, Jackie isn't too keen on this idea, but eventually, she agrees. She'll take the free trip and see what happens. It's June 2nd, 1953. Jackie's outside of Buckingham Palace. She's got her camera around her neck and she's found a few Brits to interview. She asks, do you think Elizabeth will be England's last queen? Jackie returns to her hotel and publishes the story. A couple days later, she receives a telegram. It reads, article's excellent, but you are missed. Love, Jack.
Whoa, Janet was right. Did not see that coming.
I know, right? And then Jackie gets a phone call. She answers it in her soft, breathy voice. Hello? Though his voice crackles, she can hear his thick Boston accent. It's Jack. He gets right to it. He spoke with Blackjack and got his blessing. And then he says the words, "Will you marry me?"
Over the fucking phone?
Yep. And it appears Jackie feels the same way as you about the proposal. She says she'll think about it.
Good.
Yeah. She loves him. There's no doubt about that. But now that she's almost gotten what she wants, she panics. Jackie asks a friend, "How can you live with a husband who's bound to be unfaithful? Even if you love that person, how can you put up with that and not lose a large piece of yourself?" Jackie hops over to Paris for a few days to clear her mind. It's even rumored that while she's there, she briefly rekindles a relationship with an ex.
Ooh la la.
But Jackie's heart pulls her back to Boston. Jack meets her at the airport where he presents her with an almost 3-carat diamond engagement ring set with an equally large emerald. He places the ring on her finger and Jackie gives the official yes to becoming Mrs. John F. Kennedy.
Oh, we finally got our airport engagement.
We did. And Jackie gets her happy ending. She's marrying a man who excites her and she's not going to be a boring housewife. She's going to be a Kennedy wife.
Well, this is our third Kennedy arc, so I know how that turns out.
Yeah. Getting Jack to propose was the easy part. Being married to him, that's going to be a lot harder. This is episode one of our 3-part series, JFK and Jackie. We use many sources when researching our stories, like the New York Times, the Washington Post, and Vanity Fair. But we especially recommend 4 books: JFK, Coming of Age in the American Century, 1917 to 1956, by Friedrich Loggeval; The Fabulous Bouvier Sisters, The Tragic and Glamorous Lives of Jackie and Lee, by Nancy Schoenberger and Sam Kashner; Jacqueline Bouvier Kennedy Onassis, The Untold Story, by Barbara Leeming; and These Few Precious Days by Christopher Anderson. I'm Arisha Skidmore-Williams.
And I'm Brooke Sifrin. Elizabeth Kosen wrote this episode with editing by Allison Reimer. Our audio engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Sound design by James Morgan. Kate Young is our associate producer. Natalie Shisha is our producer. Our executive producers are Stephanie Jens, Jenny Lauer-Beckman, and Marshall Louie for Wondery.
Welcome to the small town of Chinook, where faith runs deep and secrets run deeper. In this new thriller, available exclusively on Wondery Plus, religion and crime collide when a gruesome murder rocks the isolated Montana community. Everyone is quick to point their fingers at a drug-addicted teenager, but local deputy Ruth Vogel isn't convinced. She suspects connections to a powerful religious group. Enter federal agent V.B. Loro, who has been investigating a local church for possible criminal activity. The pair form an unlikely partnership to catch the killer, unearthing secrets that leave Ruth torn between her duty to the law, her religious convictions, and her very own family. But something more sinister than murder is afoot, and someone is watching Ruth. With an all-star cast led by Emmy nominee Sanaa Lathan and Star Wars Kelly Marie Tran, Chinook is available exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.